You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. What do Jack the Ripper, Jesse James, the Texas Servant Girl Annihilator, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and Jack the Kisser have in common? They were all subjects of true crime newspaper reporting in the 1800s. And now these stories and that of many others are brought together in their original form in a two-volume set, True Crime Chronicles, Serial Killers, Outlaws, and Justice, Real Crime Stories from the 1800s. Compiled and commented on by New York Times bestselling author and former detective Mike Rothmiller, these classic works of journalism resurrect astonishing stories that will take the reader on a fascinating journey back in time to when these horrific tales mesmerized a nation. Some may find these articles and their descriptions of people and crimes shocking by today's standards, but they are representative of the most colorful true crime stories of the day. True Crime Chronicles, Volume 2, includes stories about Billy the Kid, Jesse James, the legendary Jack the Ripper, Lizzie Halliday, Anna Marie Zwanziger, Jack the Haircutter, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, the Nebraska Murderer, and many more shocking stories. Follow along as these reporters from another century visit the crime scenes, interview witnesses, and pen the stories of murder, evil, and swift frontier justice. The book that we're featuring this evening is True Crime Chronicles, Volume 2, Serial Killers, Outlaws, and Justice, Real Crime Stories from the 1800s, with my special guest, journalist and author and true crime historian, Mike Rothmiller. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Mike Rothmiller.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. This is a fascinating, fascinating book. Let's talk about, for those that didn't hear the earlier interview this month for the Volume 1, maybe you can just repeat or reiterate basically the intention of this and the unique format used to convey these incredible stories.
Sure. A little bit of background on it. I was researching another book in various archives, and I kept coming across fascinating stories that were written in newspapers regarding serial killers and other outlaws and so forth. And the way they were written, they were very dramatic, very detailed, and very grisly in some cases. And they just fascinated me. And I thought that was rather interesting because those stories mesmerized the country at the time. So I decided to bring those forward, resurrect those stories as they were written, because I couldn't do a better job describing it. And if I did on some of these serial killers, people would say, well, geez, that sounds crazy. How do you know
right.
this? Well, this is from the reporters who were there at the scene and attended the trials and the lynchings and everything. So it was firsthand information. In some cases, it ends up being witness testimony, and it's just absolutely fascinating the detail they get into, what they were able to cover. And what I, speaking of then, when I was a detective, there are certain things that you told the press, but you held back a lot.
Right.
In these stories, nothing was held back. They talk about the type of crime, the injuries, they describe them in great detail to the victims. They describe the weapons used, where the bodies were found, how they were found, and ones that were mutilated, how they were mutilated. So it's just, it's a fascinating read. It gets into a great deal of detail that people just don't read today, unless it's in a novel somewhere. But you certainly would not read that type of information in a newspaper today. So with that in mind, I decided to keep the stories as they were written, and then provide a commentary from my perspective about these stories and why they were significant or what made them very, very strange beyond what was written. And I wrote that from a historian and a detective's point of view to basically all the stories that are in both the books, Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Right. Now, in terms of the contents, you have the intro, then you have serial killers, the other Jacks, the Old West, the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln, and you have short crime stories.
Yes.
So let's start with and you mentioned that you usually have a commentary here before the story or afterwards. You start off with, of course, the most infamous true crime story ever and character, Jack the Ripper. Give us your commentary that you provide for this, the articles that you present about Jack the Ripper.
I introduce the crime itself, because there's some people, even though it's very, very famous, they do not know about Jack the Ripper. And so I had to provide some background about that and the time frame and where it was occurring and what this person was doing and how many basically female prostitutes were brutally murdered and a lot of them dismembered by him. And sometimes it just some very strange things that he did to their body. So I lay that out. I lay out what happened in that area called Whitechapel in New York and why, pardon me, not New York, in London, and why it was considered a lower class area where there are prostitutes and a lot of criminals and so forth. And then I get into the issue of people who are identifying various men. Said, I think this guy's Jack the Ripper and that guy's Jack the Ripper. And the first guy they labeled was called the Leather Apron, who was the first killing. And that's because they found a leather apron at one scene. And they said, well, gee, there must be this guy. And so they started calling him the Leather Apron Killer. So that's background information for people. That's very useful. And then I get into one of the articles, too, regarding the chief of detectives for Scotland Yard who headed up the investigation. Mm-hmm. And what he had to say during his interview about Jack the Ripper. And ultimately, he states, and I've been able to verify a lot of it since then, that they did, in fact, capture Jack the Ripper. And I talk about it in there. But they didn't have enough to convict him in a criminal court. So under the power of the crown, which was power of the queen, they decided, okay, they went to their Secretary of State, basically, and said, this is the guy who's been doing it, he's insane. And so with a single stroke of a pen, he was put into a mental hospital for the criminally insane, and they called it the lunatic asylum. And so this is where I get into, and all the stories talk about this, who Jack the Ripper was, the revelations about him made by the chief of detectives. And if, quite frankly, if anybody knew about Jack the Ripper, it's going to be the chief of detectives who handled it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so his interview is in there about the entire story.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had never actually read that conclusion that they had captured Jack the Ripper and then put him in an insane asylum. I never read that conclusion, and as many Jack the Ripper books have been featured on this program. So,
yes, I know. And like I said, since then, I have a colleague. We co-written a book that will come out in July in London, and we've dug up more information confirming it, that Jack the Ripper was in fact captured by Scotland Yard and put into the Broadmoor Lunatic Asylum, as they call it. So we're going to dig a little bit deeper. We're still digging, and we'll probably, I think, within another few months, once their archives open up for people to go in, we'll probably be able to identify who Jack the Ripper was.
Wow, that's incredible. You have a section called The Other Jacks. What is The Other Jacks about?
Well, The Other Jacks, that if anything, that was a little lighter part of Jack, and they called several different people, and it went through time, but mainly in the East Coast. But one was Jack the Haircutter, Jack the Kisser, Jack the Hugger, and Jack the Cutter. And basically what it was during the 1800s, primarily in New York and Washington and some other areas on the East Coast, Jack the Haircutter, there were a lot of wannabe Jack the Haircutters once the word got out. But when a woman or a girl would be walking down the street, she's got long hair or ponytails, these guys would run up to them, grab them, and generally with a straight razor or scissors, cut off their ponytails, keep the ponytails and the long hair, and run away. And this was not uncommon. There were a lot of copycats going on. So that is Jack the Haircutter, and the stories are in there about him. Jack the Kisser was just what it says. Once again, there were copycats in the same locations, and they would ride their buggies or a horse, and they're walking down the street, and they'd see a girl or a woman. They would grab her and then kiss her, and the one guy, the main guy, would generally end up with a poem. He'd tell them some poem, and then they would take off. They would disappear. So that was very popular. Jack the Hugger, as it states, these guys would see a woman, and they would run up to her and hug her, and the woman would fight, try to get away. They'd keep hugging her, then they would let her go, and they would run away. And that was a very popular, if you want to say, it was a crime in a sense, but sometimes I think a lot of these, the articles I read were maybe joking, but they were copycats. Jack the Cutter was a interesting character who did not like long dresses on women that were dragging on the ground. So those are primarily in Washington, D.C. that this occurred, but he would see some woman with a long skirt, and if it was dragging on the ground, he would jump out with a pair of scissors or shears. He would run up to them, he'd grab them, and he would cut their dresses off another 6 or 7 inches so they wouldn't drag on the ground. And so that was more of a, sounds like more of a fetish in some bizarre way. So that was Jack the Cutter. So when I was doing the research, quite frankly, I didn't know about any of these other Jacks. And I thought the stories were so interesting because they all occurred around the same period of time. And I just thought I had to include them because they were so unusual and so different. So that's how all the other Jacks ended up being in the book.
Let's go to a far more incredible story. September 11th, 1893, and you have the Courier News, and the headline, A Murderous Maniac. And for the audience, the term maniac is used in these articles all the time, it seems. Anyway, this is crimes charged against Lizzie Halliday, and a mania like Jack the Ripper. She killed and mutilated her first husband in the same manner as second. And then the McQuillan women were murdered through a thirst for blood. Tell us what you have to say about Lizzie Halliday and why this story was so compelling.
Well, Lizzie, the primary reason, there are very few serial killers who are women through time. Generally, they're men, and in most cases, younger men. So that was of interest immediately. And then when I started reading the articles about her, I realized that she was, probably for most of her life, she would be considered insane. And she just would kill. She killed a couple of her husbands. And she would kill for a variety of reasons, but truly they were never known. And so she was eventually convicted and imprisoned. And there was one woman who basically was like a warden, they call them, and their guards, who pretty much befriended her and was able to control her because she was just really wild. She would attack people for no reason or whatever her reason was. Nobody really knew. And so when this woman finally told her that she was leaving the prison system, Lizzie got upset and just decided to go ahead and try to stab her to death in prison. She just attacked her, and then Lizzie ended up, after she was convicted of these other murders of Sarah Quinlan and Eloquent McQuinlan, she was the first woman to be electrocuted in the United States to receive the death penalty. So she was very, very strange, very diabolical, and as some of the articles pointed out, they said that she was the worst woman on earth, because they pretty much narrowed it down that she killed five people, her husband, stepson, two women friends, and then the nurse in the asylum where she was sentenced. So she was very, very different, very bizarre, and as far as a story, a very interesting story.
You include the Texas Servant Girl Annihilator, 1884, in Austin, Texas, and this city in a state of panic. And the seven or more women were murdered, apparently, by the serial killer using an axe or a knife. Tell us a little bit more about this Texas Servant Girl.
Yeah, in most cases, the women were African-American, and in many cases they were young, and what they were is they were, for a better term, acting as live-in maids, live-in cooks, and so forth, in some wealthy or upper-class white families. And this guy would come in at night when everybody was asleep and, generally speaking, kill them in their bed. With an axe, he would split their skulls wide open, and the articles talk about how the brains are all over the room and so forth. But he would do this, and they believed eventually, and all the other research said, that he was probably an African-American man, but they weren't quite sure. And so he went into this guy went into one room with whether he was a copycat or not, and there were two women in there, two white girls, and he attacked them in the same way. He'd either cut their throats, but generally an axe was used, and he would go for the head or go for the neck. A few times, bodies were taken outside of the bedroom where the initial attack occurred. He would drag them off maybe 50, 60, 100 yards, and then he would just go at them with an axe or a knife and leave the body. But he was never caught. They had suspicions one time. They had a description of a guy who did attack these two girls who were both white. But once again, they never caught him, and he took off. But the Texas Servant Girl Annihilator was, that's what they called him in the newspaper article, and that's what he did. He just annihilated servant girls. And then there was question worried because all of a sudden the murders stopped and they started happening in other locations. And they were very concerned that this is the Texas Servant Girl Annihilator and he's just relocated to another city. And it was reoccurring. Whether that's true or not, nobody knows at this time. It may have been the same person. It may have been a copycat. They just don't know. But a very interesting story about a man who used an axe, most cases, and just would brutally murder people in their bedroom.
You have a story of Anna Maria Zwanziger, born in 1760 and beheaded September 1811 for murder. And this is, she worked in several German homes as a housekeeper and cook. What was her preference for people she worked with and people she killed?
Her preference was generally she wanted to work for judges and upper middle class people. And her favorite way of taking out people was with poison. And so she would poison people, and they would get very ill, and she would pretend that she's nursing them back to health and so forth. A few times that worked. Many times the person died. And so they were able to check for various poisons back then. There are various coroners around the world, and they kept coming up. Arsenic was a very favorite poison to use then, and they would find it, and they eventually convicted her, and as you said, she was executed. But she just had a passion for using poison as opposed to a knife or a gun or anything else. But she was just a very, very disturbed and very interesting woman.
Yes, absolutely. You have a story called The Nebraska Killer. What's the most notable characteristic or thing about this killer that you noted and you included in this?
He was very cold and calculating. And when he was arrested, they were taking him by train back to Nebraska to stand trial. And some reporters got on the train with them. And as I said, they would just go ahead and conduct interviews. And the police would say, hey, this is great. Go ahead and talk to the guy. And in most cases, these people would come out with a confession, say, yeah, I did this, I did that. But he ended up killing six people that they know of and that they prosecuted him for. He is only in his early 20s. But he was extremely cool and collected when he was talking to reporters. But the one thing he was really interested in is that there was no spinning in these stories. No spinning by the reporters, no embellishment, and no fake news. He just wanted the facts to come out about him, what he did, and his, if you want to say his reasoning for doing it. But he was just a very, very disturbed individual once again. And he would just, matter of fact, talk to the reporters very slow, very cunning. And one of the people that he killed after he killed this family was a baby, and the baby continued to cry, and so he just got mad, and he killed the baby, and they said, well, basically, why did you kill the baby? He said, well, it wouldn't shut up, kept crying, and so he did that, then he basically dumped the bodies next to the house and covered them up and took off, but a very cold, calculated character, and reading his interview from the reporters, it really gets into his mind how he worked. And obviously he was a serial killer at that stage. He murdered quite a few. And then you just step back and you say, okay, this is his logic. This is what he's saying. And it is very bizarre because you're in these stories, it's actually that you're listening to him. You're sitting there as the reporter listening to him talk about this and making his confession and so forth. And you walk away from going, this guy was nuts and very deadly, and it's kind of frightening to a lot of people. Because there are people like that today. Yeah.
Yeah. He. It's interesting, especially because he wanted only the truth to be had by these reporters to document the truth, and yet that's inconsistent with the barbarity of the crimes that he did. You would think it was someone where it would be questionable the crime somewhat, and he would be worried about the perception by the public, but it did make sense, his request, that they be accurate, especially given the brutality of these murders. A baby with an iron in the face and crushing skulls.
Yes, and so when you step back and look, wait a minute, it's how is his brain working? And what is the logic behind this? Like a lot of these serial killers, like Lizzie, she was insane. This guy, you can say he's insane, but in like a lot of them, he probably wasn't. And you just wonder, okay, now he knows or he has to anticipate he's going to be found guilty, he's going to be executed. So why is he so concerned about this at this stage and insistent that, hey, you print the facts, not the nonsense, just the facts. And so it takes you into the mind of a killer and how they thought about their situation at the time. And some of these people are like this guy. You wouldn't want to meet him on a dark night anywhere. He's just like the Texas Servant Girl Annihilator and so forth. Very scary people, very brutal, and very dangerous.
In this section you still call serial killers, we've covered this with an author in January, the Atlanta Ripper, but it's worth mentioning again because of the incredible nature of these crimes. The Atlanta Ripper is named because there is some association with Jack the Ripper. Tell us a little bit about the incredible Atlanta Ripper.
Yeah, he was basically during the early 19th, about 1910, somewhere around 1911. He would basically work like Jack the Ripper did. He would work the streets and a lot of times hit alleys, and he would attack women, not just prostitutes, but any woman walking along of any age. It could be a mother, a working class woman, and all of his victims were black, and basically he would attack them on deserted streets in very dark places. He would ambush them. Obviously they wouldn't see him coming, and all of them were killed there on the scene. A lot of times he would, what they were speculating, that he would use an axe, a hand axe, or hard object, and hit them in the head. Probably kill them outright, if not certainly cause issues. And then he would just go ahead and cut the throat or let them bleed out or behead them. And the murders generally always occurred on Saturday night, and the bodies were discovered on Sunday morning. So in Atlanta at the time, there were loads of men who were arrested on suspicion, and they were all let go. And the killer remains unknown to this day. Whether it was one person working alone or two or what, nobody knows. But he's just another, I'm saying he, assuming it was he, he's just another serial killer that just vanished. And nobody was ever proven to be that person. They have it up to at least 18 girls, females were killed by him, but they don't know if that's a complete number or how accurate it is, because a lot of them, they just found the bodies and they said, well, we think it's him, but we really can't be sure. But it sent a panic through that entire community, especially for women who were working into the evening, whether they were servants in a home or at a factory or whatever. And when they were going home, especially African-American women, they were the targets, and so they were terrified at night. And it went on for a while until finally he just kind of vanished.
You talk about the New York Ripper. Excuse me. What I found most interesting was you talk of the fear of Jack the Ripper leaving London and traveling to other parts of the world.
Yes.
And this is what the New York Ripper is about. Just tell us about that. Continue.
Yeah, that was an interesting case. It was right after, a few years after Jack the Ripper was active in Whitechapel in London. And they started having some deaths occurring of primarily prostitutes who were found nearly killed in the same fashion as Jack the Ripper in London. And I mean, their bodies were mutilated. I know there was one that the guy removed, I'm assuming it's a guy again, removed the woman's intestines and coiled them up on a table next to it, removed organs. Some of the organs of these people were missing. So he took time to not only kill them, but to dismember them. And by taking the various body parts, you're assuming that he's taking a trophy. Because I know a few of the murders I dealt with as a detective, that they would take sometimes clothing, sometimes part of the body, as a souvenir, as a reminder of this murder they committed. And so what was really sad about that, there was a guy that's staying in a hotel, Middle Eastern fellow, was not fluent in English, and he was basically down the hall from this one woman that was found mutilated, and his name was Frenchie. And for some reason, the detectives, probably because of pressure they're getting, arrested him, and he was charged and so forth. But as it turned out, and it, all the information's in here and how it, it happened and went down, he was not the murderer. But they were just fine with having him go to prison and probably be executed, they were thinking in the beginning. And he was not the guy. And so what happened was there were a number of reporters who were at the scene, and the detective claimed that there was a blood trail leading from that room into his room. And they were there right when the detective was. And they said, wait a minute, there was no blood trail. And other things that he talked about, the detective. And so finally they brought this up, and the governor pardoned this man after a number of years. And right. Why the detective or detectives falsified the information and the evidence to convict this guy, you'll just never know. And, you know, it's something that's horrible, because this guy could have been easily executed, and even today, things like that occur. But the New York Ripper, as this guy was known as, just vanished once again. Nobody knows who he was.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for this break for our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. My favorite guilty pleasure right now is watching Netflix. True crime docs like the recent The Night Stalker. Another guilty pleasure right now is playing Best Fiends. It's always a lot of fun to play. Best Fiends is a unique match 3 puzzle game with literally thousands of levels and new content added constantly. I've just started playing a few weeks ago, and I'm already on level 50 and obsessed. There are more and more tough challenges. It's easy to play, but you want badly to get more levels. Playing Best Fiends has been a great way to get my mind off all the serious stuff I read every day. The characters to kill the evil slugs are very entertaining, but the increasing challenges make me want to continue. I love the challenges. I think my listeners might love it too. With over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is definitely a must play. Once you download Best Fiends, you'll get used to telling yourself, just one more level. With more levels, events, and challenges added every month, so you can binge and never be bored. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R, Best Fiends. Now, Mike, the next section in your book is the Old West, and remarkably and incredibly, you talk about all of the people that we think we know through movies like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. In 1969, Paul Newman and Robert Redford portrayed these outlaws in this feature film. You have a commentary for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. What is that?
Well, basically, it's their true story. We've seen the movies, we've read books, we've heard stories, and in most cases, they're wrong. These guys were outlaws, they were doing various things, but what was always interesting is that in the movie, they were, you know, Redford and Newman portrayed these guys. Yeah, they were criminals, but they were kind of just fun-loving guys, you know. Yeah, they were pulling some robberies and this, but they really didn't want to hurt anybody with a romantic twist. Well, that's what most people believe, but these articles get into it. They weren't fun-loving guys. They were ruthless criminals, and they killed a lot of people, and they're always involved in criminal activity for a long time. They had, from some of the articles, they're talking about how Butch Cassidy, for a better term, ran, if you want to say, a small army in the Rocky Mountains of about 500 outlaws.
Wow.
And, yeah, and then they would move through different areas. But then finally, there was a secret conference that was conducted with the governors of Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and I believe it was Idaho, that they had to stop Cassidy. And they had to, for a better term, they had to put together their group of people to try to hunt them down. And so it gets into the whole story about how bad these fellows really were. And it goes from, for better term, from their beginning to their end in Bolivia. And basically what happened after they were being chased down here in the early 1900s, and a lot of their, if you want to say, their captains of their outlaw gang were captured or killed and kind of went their own way, they took off and went to first through Mexico and Central America, and they ended up Bolivia. And then they started up robbing people again, robbing trains, stagecoaches, whatever it was. And they killed several people in Bolivia, and then they were running again as they're being chased down into Argentina in that area. But it ended up in Bolivia where they found them hiding out, and they had a shootout with some troops, military troops, and they were killed at the time. But what is interesting is that even today, a lot of people believe that they escaped and that they made it back to the U.S. and continued just a quiet life. That is interesting, but the Bolivians, the people, the soldiers, they killed two guys and they buried them down there. And everybody, all historians, I say, believe that that is absolutely true, that they were buried, and the rest of it is just folklore, that they made it back to the States and they lived quietly ever after. But this sets the record straight because these stories were written at the time, and it gets into what bad guys they truly were, them and their gang, and how long they terrorized a section of the country. So it will enlighten a lot of people.
Absolutely. You include a story called the Manketo Executions, particularly disturbing. 38 Sioux Indians hung, 1862.
Yes.
While the Civil War in the U.S. was raging. Tell us about this story and the coverage.
Yes, really, really interesting. Well, the press coverage was nothing. It was literally two sentences, and that was it. And what happened was around 1862, the Sioux Nation up in the Dakotas, for a better term, they were being invaded by a lot of settlers moving in, taking their lands, killing off all the game that they survived on. And a hunting party was out one day, and they ran some people, and they hunting party about five or six Sioux, and they killed these people, these white people that were there. So that got everybody obviously very upset that the Sioux were doing this. And the Civil War was raging. It wasn't going well for Lincoln and the Union. And so Lincoln had to do something, and he was getting pressured heavily because this could be the start of another war with the Indian nations. And then he was worried that, well, if they start fighting the Sioux, they've got to pull soldiers away from fighting the Confederates. And then he was concerned that the other Indian nations may join the Sioux. And quite frankly, at the time, the Plains Indians were the best horsemen around and probably the best soldiers around. And so he authorized to have the army go in there and basically try to make a deal and bring these people in. And they said, okay, they'll do that. So they went out, they kind of negotiated with this one chief, and he brought in his warriors, and they were arrested. They brought in basically about 400 to 500. The records aren't completely clear on that, but they brought them in. They surrendered, and then they decide, okay, we're going to put all these guys on trial, all these Sioux Indians. So
right.
They have a military tribunal. Some of the trials of these fellows were about a minute long or 30 seconds. They said, what's your name? They give the Indian name. They say, fine, you're guilty. You're going to die. And the next guy, please. So they ran through this. They send a letter to Abraham Lincoln, this general does, with all these Indian names. He wants to hang all of them. All of them found guilty. He wants to execute all of them. And it was over 400. Lincoln Zelerkian says, no, 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 wait, we can't just arbitrarily hang, you know, 400 to 500 Sioux Indians, because that will not go well in the country, especially within the Indian nation. So he narrows it down. He says, well, just give me the ones that raped white women. So that came down to a very short list, just a couple. He says, well, that's not good. We've got to execute more to show that we're serious about this and to try to dissuade them from killing more whites. So he's personally selected 38 names, Indian names, to hang them. He issued the order. It goes up. So they have a massive gallows built to hang all of them at one time. They bring in the soldiers. They surround the area. They start calling off the names of the Sioux to take their place under the hangman's noose. And they call them off, and they walk up there, and they start singing the death song, the death chant, and they hang them all. Boom, they're done, 38 of them. Well, they find out later that two of them that they hung by mistake. They were young kids.
Right.
And it's just that when this soldier called off the names, the kid said, well, that's me, because he mispronounced it. So they walked up, and they were hung by mistake.
Wow.
They were completely innocent. So they take the bodies, they bury them in the sand down by the river, and then some other people go in afterwards, some whites, for souvenirs, for body parts, and they take bodies to sell them to doctors and to, for a better term, medical schools, so they could perform autopsies on these cadavers and just learn from them. So they do that. So all these people are killed. It's the largest mass execution in American history, yet in 1863, I think it was the Summit County Beacon, they basically had six words about it. It's just on the date, 36 Sioux Indians hung in Minnesota. That was it. And then in 1881, there was an article about one of the boards, or the 2x4s or 4x4s that were used from the gallows to hang the Indians, that it was being donated to the State University of Museum in St. Paul, and that was a great artifact. They're proud to have it. And then later on in 1890, there's an article about a guy coming into town, and he has a scalp from one of the Sioux that was hung back then. He got it from his brother-in-law, who was a soldier. So what's interesting is that it's the largest mass execution in U.S. history, and yet the first article was all of about six words. That's it. And that just shows you how Native Americans at the time were looked at. I mean, if they killed 36 dogs or something, or cattle, it would have probably had the same response in the newspaper. So it just takes you back to a time, and you can understand how Native Americans were looked at the time. And we still had, you know, years down the road, the Indian Wars, but you just look at it and say, wow, it's only six words when they hung all these people, and two of them by mistake, two kids. And that's all it warranted in the media.
Yes, incredible. Let's talk about another person that is immortalized and fictionalized, and Billy the Kid. Tell us what you found out about Billy the Kid that opposes the mythology.
Well, really the true story about him, and a lot of it we've heard, but a lot of it is, if you want to say, twisted, because different people didn't have the information, or they wanted to write the story or the book in a different fashion. But these articles were written at the time. They were written by reporters who spoke to some of the people that were around him over the years, and really talking about how many people he killed and how many his gang ended up killing and how ruthless he was. And then eventually he was killed. That's the way it's been reported in the newspaper articles too, by Sheriff Pat Garrett, when Billy was hiding out at a ranch after he escaped, killed two deputies in town, and he escaped, went out to this ranch, and they went out, and at dark snuck up on the house, and Garrett went into the room, and that's when he saw the person he said was Billy the Kid walk in, and that's when he shot him. So it gets into what really occurred at the time, not what contemporary stories say or television, but it gives you a good look at, well, Pat Garrett, the sheriff at the time, and the history of Billy the Kid when he started out, and through his life what he did, and how many people he did kill, and how ruthless he was.
You also debunk the story, or at least you discuss the story that even some newspapers spoke about the idea that he had escaped and went on to live his life somewhere else, and that Pat Garrett, his former friend, the sheriff who had shot him, apparently just substituted a different corpse. It was so you talk about that that story. It's widely
popular.
Yeah,
well, that's what some people started saying, is that when Billy was shot out of Las Vegas, New Mexico, that it really wasn't him, that it was somebody else, and Garrett decided to bring this body and say, no, this is him, because there was a reward then, but also for the notoriety. He wanted him killed, that he escaped. But the odds are it was, once again, it was Billy the Kid, and just setting, you know, history straight, is that this was written at the time, and these reporters would crawl in there and talk to him, talk to the people that were out there when he was shot and so forth. And so there's no doubt that, in my mind, that Billy was killed then.
Absolutely. You also talk about Jesse James, and you have a particular commentary about Jesse James. Again, one of those people that, one of those outlaws that people believe through some movies and some stories that they know about Jesse James, and you set the record straight. Tell us about a little bit about Jesse James.
Yeah, Jesse started out really killing people with Quantrell's Raiders during the Civil War. He first went there after there's killing at his parents' ranch and so forth, and his brother Frank was already riding with Quantrell's Raiders. And so Jesse went one time. He wanted to join. They said, no, you're too young. Get out of here. He came back later when he was still young. And well, I'm saying young, I'm talking 15, 16, 17. And he joined Quantrell's Raiders. And they were a band affiliated with the Confederacy, and they would raid various cities, mainly along in Kansas and that area. And he bragged that he killed, at least 36 to 40 people in this one raid in Lawrence, Kansas, when they went in there. And they basically killed all of the men and all the boys in that town, and it was approaching about 200, maybe a little bit more than that. And as a result of that, the Confederacy, for a better term, pulled their support from Quantrell because they didn't want people just being slaughtered just to be slaughtered, especially boys and so forth and innocent men. And so Jesse, in that raid, claimed he killed 36, probably did, maybe more, maybe a few less, but it's just a matter of he was very, very vicious. And then he went on with his brother, Frank James and so forth, and they formed their own gang, and they started pulling robberies and so forth of banks and of stagecoaches and so forth, because that's what they knew from riding with Quantrell, that that's what they would do. And finally, he and his group were so sought after in terrorizing that area of the nation that the governor basically was hiring people to go out and find him, for a better term, almost like private detectives and so forth, and other criminals, and to eliminate him. And so eventually, that's exactly what happened. There were a couple of guys who were no better than Jesse, came to the house as friends. He knew him in the past. And when they were in the living room chatting, Jesse went to straighten a picture on the wall and dust it off, and he was shot from behind and by one of these friends of his. And so eventually they were both, if you want to say, indicted, put on trial. It was very rapid, and it was over quickly, but there's no doubt in anybody's mind that the governor knew about this well in advance, and these articles talk about this, how he knew these two guys and basically was talking about, yeah, go out and see if you can get them. But then they go into the body of Jesse, and when they're describing the body, the reporters, or this particular reporter, had a fascination with him and talking about he had a magnificent physique, and this is when he's laid out dead, and that he's you know, is in his pride of health and strength, and he was a commanding figure and all this sort of stuff. And so even then, the legend of Jesse James was being built by some of the reporters that were there, the way they described everything and examining the body and so forth. So it's a very interesting story about the history of Jesse and Frank James and so forth. And it brings up a lot of areas that, excuse me, just are not covered in other books or stories, television, so forth.
It's fascinating that you talk about the $10,000 reward and then the motivation for this Robert and Charles to be able to try to kill this person that they knew. And they
yes.
hooked up with the detective, as you write, and said, listen, we know these guys. I've known them for 4 or 5 years, so they could identify them. But they also knew the country. They knew the layout, the countryside. And so they figured between them that they had to kill him. There was no way they were going to take this guy prisoner. So they wanted to get close to him, and it was lucky that Jesse James needed some people for a bank robbery. He hadn't robbed a bank
right.
in a while and was low on funds. So they gained his trust that way. And it's fascinating, to, as you write, that they had to wait till his back was turned and he had no access to weapons, so to make sure that they could kill this person and get that reward. And
yeah,
later,
I think they were terrified of him, I believe, and that's why because there were two of them. They could have pulled their guns on him any time when he's standing there or the day before or whatever, but they didn't, so they waited until he was turned his back. They shot him. His wife was in another room in the house. She ran into that living room area and realized what happened, and these two guys took off. But they went basically to the sheriff after that and said, hey, we just killed Jesse James. And that was pretty much the end of it. But in a sense, they became heroes to some and villains to other, because there are a lot of people who, at the time, they were intrigued by Jesse James, as they were a lot of other outlaws, and especially if they were supporters of the Confederacy and they knew that they were with the Confederacy fighting with them. So it's interesting. It brings both sides into play. It brings the true horrible outlaw that they were and killers, but then you also see the other side of how some people, and especially the reporters, viewed them. Yeah, they were criminals, but kind of romantic criminals in a sense. So it's very interesting the way the stories are written, because as I mentioned earlier, they don't hold anything back. They talk in detail about the wounds
right.
and what went on and so forth. So it's just, it takes people to a different level regarding the history of Jesse and Frank James.
You also write that when Jesse was 14 and his older brother was in the Quantrails, that they wouldn't allow him into the gang, but then his stepfather, Dr. Samuels, you write, a pronounced secessionist. He had the visit from these Union soldiers, and so they strung him up, ropes produced, and strung him up, and he was later cut down, but Jesse's mother and sister were imprisoned. And so that, at 14, as you write, it set him off on his murderous future, didn't it?
Yes, it did. He at that stage, he obviously he hated the Union more than he had in the past. And after he saw the personal attack by the soldiers on his family, that was it. He did whatever snapped in him or didn't snap, or that was his decision. Said, okay, I am going to go with my brother and, for a better term, seek retribution for my family on the Union, people of the Union at the time, and not the Confederacy. So, yeah, for a young boy at the time, he was ruthless.
Yes, absolutely. You include at the end of this book several true crime stories. We don't have time to go into them, but what are some of these stories, these articles, these headlines, what do they indicate and tell you, and why were they included?
Okay. Well, the one I have in there about Lincoln's assassination, but in the short stories, they're interesting because some of them were, most of them are only maybe 100 words. They're very short, but they get into society at the time. What was, if you want to say, acceptable, and what was not acceptable, and how people would react to it. Like there's one I have in there. This gal was dating this guy, and he was also dating another woman. And so he took this other woman out for a buggy ride. This other woman, she knows they're going out, so she gets in a buggy. She goes after him, and she catches up, and she shoots and kills both of them. So is jealousy at play, which you see today. There was one truly interesting story, but it was repeated many times in other stories, and that was it sounds crazy, but the deadly blue gum Negro, which they said. And what they believed was that if an African-American had blue gums, his bite was as deadly as a rattlesnake. And so I found numerous articles about this back then, and I put this one in, how they went to arrest this guy. He bit some people, and they died afterwards. They said, see, that proves that he's a blue gum Negroes are as deadly as rattlesnakes. And it was folklore that was believed for many, many years. And as I put in there, here's the story, but then I also put in there from the Cleveland Clinic about human bites, how they can become badly infected, and especially then the no antibiotics. You break the skin with no antibiotics, especially from a human bite, there's a chance it's going to become infected, and then you're going to die from the infection. So that was one I found very interesting. There's another where typical con men, they had them back then, where they pull in and they're well-dressed. They see this guy sitting on his porch, basically a rancher, and they want to buy it, and they pull out some gold bricks and said, here's what we're going to buy it with. So they cut the deal. They get some cash in advance, and the guy finds out these bricks are not gold. He was scammed. And there's some really kind of interesting ones where they found his body, and they didn't know if it was a joke or murder because it was all pretty well mutilated, but they pretty much determined that it was cadaver from a medical school that some guys took out and chopped it up and shot it up and dumped it in the river. But the most interesting one at the very end I closed the book with was a defense of a woman in Washington, D.C. during the Civil War, and she was captured by the Union aiding and abetting, acting as a spy and an aide for the Confederacy. So each time they'd catch her, they would go, and that was execution then. And so shortly afterwards, the general in charge that was holding her would receive a notice from Washington, D.C., release her. So this happened several times, and obviously it was puzzling to this general because everybody else would be hung or shot. Well, as it turned out, she was running a brothel and an abortion clinic in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And so what she did, she was servicing a lot of the politicians. high-ranking politicians, maybe Secretary of State and sort of congressmen and senators, and she was also performing the abortions on their girlfriends. And so this is why she kept getting off as a Confederate spy. But then she actually shoots somebody, a guy she was blackmailing. She gets on a, for better term, a trolley, and she shoots at him. She misses, kills the guy next to him, and wounds this other one. And she goes on trial, and she's found not guilty of this. And what is interesting is that the what got me onto is, having been in court many times, you know, testifying, is that the defense attorney basically wanted her to be found insane because then she would go free. And so the question was asked, well, how insane? He said, well, just insane enough to get her off, you know.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, that attorneys then, that's what they do today, you know. So,
yeah.
But the backstory on her is truly fascinating, and I wrote her entire backstory in there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The disguises and, yeah, just the all the people she slept with that she blackmailed and the incredible amount of people that she had ties with in Washington at that time.
Yes, yes, and she was always dressed like a man when she was going down to bring different supplies and information to the Confederates. So it was truly, she's a story in herself, you know.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about True Crime Chronicles, Volume 2, Serial Killers, Outlaws, and Justice, Real Crime Stories from the 1800s. For people that might want to take a look at other work, where can they go? And this is a Wild Blue Press release. And tell us about your upcoming H.H. Holmes release.
Oh, yes. Well, to find out more about me and my books, they're all available on Amazon. So just go to Amazon Books and so forth. And one just came out with that's doing really well is I obtained the, if you want to say written confession, but it's kind of a confession, a non-confession of H.H. Holmes that he wrote while he was in prison awaiting trial, and he'd eventually be executed for it. But it gets into, it comes from him, it's his words, and they're there in their entirety. And it's just fascinating because it takes you inside of that guy's mind. And he thought that, he was very intelligent, but he probably thought that he could outwit everybody. But was he setting the record straight knowing he would die? Or did he actually believe this? But if anything, it was his way of trying to pass judgment on himself that he was really an innocent guy. So that's out, and I said it is, for a better term, his diary about killing people and so forth and why he was truly innocent. So it gives another perspective. It goes inside of a serial killer's mind.
That will be fascinating. I'm very, very anxious to read that and anxious to discuss that with you on the program very, very soon. I want to thank you very much, Mike Rothmiller, for coming on and talking about True Crime Chronicles, Volume 2, Serial Killers, Outlaws, and Justice, Real Crime Stories from the 1800s. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Mike. You have a great evening. Good night.
You're welcome. Take care.
Take care.